Now, number 12. You recall who Athaliah's father and mother were. Mr. Wright, who was her father? And her mother? Jezebel. Now, if heredity counts for anything, why, she's off to a bad start in life. However, let me tell you something that this doesn't surprise you. I'll be surprised. Last semester, I shocked the class a little by saying that Jesus, our Savior, is descended from Leah, not from Rachel, among those Jacob's wives. Leah, you know, the wild cow. Truth. And Jesus is also descended from Ahab and Jezebel. Believe it or not. Athaliah, the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel, married into the royal family of the line of David, and is therefore an ancestress of every one of the kings after that from whom Jesus is descended and who are listed in his genealogy in the New Testament. Therefore, while we have to say heredity is important, it certainly isn't the only thing. Now, here's Athaliah, the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel, comes to Jerusalem as the bride of Jehoram, the prospective king, but not yet king, of the kingdom of Judah. All right, the Bible says there was none like Ahab whom Jezebel, his wife, stirred up. Ahab would have been just average, except for Jezebel. She really promoted him in evil. And you could say the same thing about this man Jehoram, who married Athaliah. He would have been just an ordinary, average, so-so wicked man, or maybe even a good man. He had a good father. But he married Athaliah, and she ruined him. A wife can be the making of a man and also the ruin of a man, and in this case it was ruin. He was extremely wicked. Now, they reigned together as king and queen for a number of years, and very wicked, very much like Ahab and Jezebel, with Athaliah, of course, right there to tell him what to do. And finally, he died, and I'm afraid they didn't mourn him very much. And his son, Ahaziah, became king, one of his sons. And this is a fellow that we met up there at Jezreel when Jehu was out on the warpath killing people. You see, Jehu was to kill the family connection of Ahab. Now, that meant in the first place, Jehoram or Joram, the king of the northern kingdom, the son of Ahab, who was reigning at the time. But here's Ahaziah, king of Judah, who belongs therefore in Jerusalem, who has gone up there on a cheer-you-up-and-get-well visit to his uncle, who had been wounded in battle fighting the Syrians. And this young king from Jerusalem is up there on a visit. And when Jehu appeared, carrying out his blood purge here, Joram had two chariots gotten ready, one for himself and one for his young nephew here. And they went out beyond the edge of town to meet Jehu face to face. And just before Joram was died, after an arrow had been put through him by Jehu, he shouted, "There's treachery, Ahaziah!" And Ahaziah, his nephew, tried to run away in his chariot, horse-drawn chariot. And Jehu said, "Get him too!" And they took out after him. They had to chase him for several miles, but they got him and killed him. And later that day, Jezebel was killed. Now, that was Ahaziah, the son of Athaliah, grandson, therefore, of Ahab and Jezebel, and killed up there near Jezreel, the northern part of the country. Jerusalem and Judah is left, therefore, without a king. Now, what does a country do when their highest executive officer is suddenly dead? Something has to be done right away. I can remember, and I expect probably everybody in this room can, the day when President Jack Kennedy was, in 1963, in November was it, suddenly assassinated in Dallas. And I can remember one, I expect Dr. Wing and I are the only ones to remember this one, when President Franklin Delano Roosevelt was not assassinated, but died suddenly. and the country was left without its chief executive. And at that time, it was especially serious because the country was at war, and the war wasn't over. Now, according to the U.S. Constitution, the vice president is to be immediately sworn in. Of course, there has to be a funeral for the deceased person and a period of mourning, but they don't wait on that. The vice president is immediately sworn in. Harry Truman was sworn in as president of the United States in a dinky justice of the peace office, or a notary public's office, I guess it was, in New England, by the light of a kerosene lamp. They don't wait on ceremony for a thing like this. And Lyndon Johnson was sworn in at the Dallas airport in the cabin of an airplane by a woman notary public or justice of the peace, I'm not sure which, notary public, I think. And no former ceremony, it was simply done. And he became the president and no longer the vice president of the United States. Since then, our Constitution has been amended, and it now provides a whole succession. Suppose the president and the vice president are both killed at the same time in some accident or something, or assassinated, or bombed to death, or whatever it is. The cabinet officers, the Speaker of the House, and so forth, in succession, the Constitution specifies the succession, one after another, of who is to be the next president. And any officer who is authorized by the law of any state to administer oaths, it may be the dinkiest notary public, but authorized by law to take affidavits or administer oaths, can swear in the next president of the United States. I suppose that's the most important thing that woman in Dallas ever did in her life, was to swear in Lyndon Johnson as the next president. Now, they didn't have a constitution like, a written constitution like we have in the Kingdom of Judah, except to the books of Moses were, in a way, their constitution, but they did have a recognized form of procedure for a situation like this. The king is suddenly dead. Well, of course, his body would be brought back to Jerusalem and buried, and they would have a period of mourning. We flew the flag out here at half-mast 30 days after President Kennedy was assassinated. And this is, was done all over the world, wherever the American flag flew. And this is standard period of mourning. The Israelites mourned Moses 30 days after his death. But as to running the country, with the king dead, the highest ranking official would be the high priest. Now, he would be a religious, not a political official, but still the highest ranking officer of the country, and it was his place and function to take a hold of the controls of the ship of state until they got another king functioning. And he would anoint and crown the next king. He had this right, according to law. In England, when Queen Elizabeth was installed, she was anointed and crowned by the Archbishop of Canterbury, a religious official, but this is, by law, his prerogative and his function, to anoint and crown and install the next ruler. And in Judah, it was the high priest. This was his place to do this, and he would have done it. And then, if the next king was underage, it was a mere child, the high priest would appoint a panel of leading citizens, respected by everyone, to advise and consent, and with their assistance, he would manage the country until the king was of age to do it himself. Now, none of these things happened in this case, except they buried the dead king and had a period of mourning, of course. But nothing else happened. And why did nothing else happen? Because Athaliah threw a monkey wrench into the machinery. You would think that this woman would be so overwhelmed with grief at the death of her son, Ahaziah, that she would have no heart for politics. If so, you misjudge Athaliah. A mere matter like the death of her son, the king, didn't faze her. She figures, this is my opening to get power. Probably been looking forward to this for a long time, a chance to reign as queen in her own right. You see, she was the widow of a previous king, but she wasn't the ruler of the country. And she is crazy for power. Athaliah is power hungry. She's power crazy. This is the only thing in this woman's life that counts. All other values fade out. Personal power. She is a terror. I'm going to say a holy terror, but I think we should say an unholy terror. So she seizes the opportunity of the momentary confusion caused by the death of the king to horn in and grab power for herself. Can you think of anything more, let's say, indecent, uncivilized, inhuman, lacking in natural affection and so forth than this? But this is what she did. The death of her son is her opportunity to satisfy her lust for power. So it says she arose and slew all the seed royal. This means the possible or potential heirs to the throne. Probably out as far as second cousins, a whole bunch of children and young people, including some of her own grandchildren. Therefore, I say she was worse than Jezebel, who killed other people's children and grandchildren. Athaliah killed her own. She is that hard and unscrupulous and wicked. Arose and slew all the seed royal. Now, do you suppose she knew who they were? These Jews, if they went to college, majored in relativity, and check over who their relations were. In the New Testament, there's a place or two where it warns against paying too much attention to genealogies and family trees. This was a habit of the Jewish people. They did this. And I venture you, Athaliah knew exactly who the heirs to the throne were, had it memorized backwards and forwards. Now, it was probably her pleasure to think this over. Did you ever read Silas Marner? Story often inflicted on high school students who are not in a position to defend themselves. Well, that's a pretty good novel, somewhat dated, but in this story, this miser, his one pleasure in life is to shut the door in the evening and bolt it and get his gold out. And he gets it out of a box, coffer box, and lays it out on the table and rumbles it around and piles it up in pyramids and then in circles and knocks it down, builds it up again, counts it, and finally puts it back and locks it up. He values money not for the good it can do for him or to other people, but just for money. That is his religion. Worship of gold. And it shrivels your soul, of course. He's a miser. This is his one satisfaction in life. Now, I bet you Athaliah's one satisfaction was to check over that list. You ever hear a song around Christmas time about Santa Claus? Santa Claus is coming to town. You better be good. You better be nice. He's made a list and checking it twice. Santa Claus is coming to town. I venture the opinion Athaliah had a list and she checked it not only twice, but every once in a while, maybe every night. Set the place up and get this out, and this is my fun. This is what I get a real kick out of. March for death. March for death. March for death. March for death. All these kids and young people, march for death. That's Athaliah for you. Talk about hard-boiled. She was so hard-boiled that, I don't know, there's no army or Marine Corps in the world could have stood this woman. And that's something. Hard boy, really tough. Mark for death. Now, do you suppose she sharpened up a big butcher knife and went out and slew these people herself? Not that she was too weak in the stomach to do the job, but do you suppose she did? What do you think? She would have the police or the gendarmes or the soldiers or some of her officers do this. And no doubt she briefed them and instructed them and gave them the list and told them to go out and do the grim job. And they did. But you recall there was one baby they couldn't find because it was successfully hidden. One heir to the throne. Do you suppose they came back and said to Athaliah, "Sorry, Your Majesty, there's one baby we just simply couldn't find"? Why, she'd have bit their head off right then. And she'd have been furious. And furthermore, she'd have taken Jerusalem apart brick by brick if she'd have known there was one baby they couldn't find. So probably, although it doesn't say this in the Bible, probably they lied to her. And came back and said, salute, you know, your majesty, mission accomplished. We got them, they're dead. And so she is led to think they're all dead. And how long she went on thinking this, we don't know, but at least this is what she thought at first. Now, this one baby's name is Joash, and he is of uncertain age, but less than 1 year. Because Athaliah reigned as queen for 6 years, and then Joash was crowned at the age of 7. Therefore, at the time when she staged her coup d'etat here, he's less than 1. Let's say, take an average 6 months old, maybe. This baby is saved alive by his aunt. Now, this is a remarkable woman. Jehoshabeah. There's a jaw-breaking five-syllable Hebrew name that you don't need to stay up nights figuring out how to spell. It's spelled three different ways in the King James Bible. Jehoshabeah. She is the aunt of this baby. Therefore, she is the sister of the dead king, Ahaziah. Therefore, also, she is the daughter of Athaliah and the granddaughter, if you please, of Ahab and Jezebel. And on top of all this, she is the wife of Jehoiada the high priest, a great and good man. Therefore, the family connection descended from Ahab, you see, are not all bad. Here's a good woman who is of the same. She is the daughter of Athaliah, but she is different from this. And she risks her life to save this baby alive. Married to the high priest. You realize these priests were married, and the high priesthood was hereditary, father to son. This goes back to Aaron, the brother of Moses, or it was supposed to. All right, at the risk of her life, she sneaks this baby away and hides it. And where did they hide this baby? Where was it? House of the Lord. That was a good place to hide it. For two reasons. In the first place, Athaliah was never known to darken a church door. She felt religious, which wasn't often. She went to the Temple of Baal. And therefore, you could pretty well count on her not getting around that place. Also, there would be a strong public feeling against soldiers or officers going in there and searching the Temple of the Lord. Although, I suppose it could be done, but there would be a strong feeling against it. So this was a good choice of a place to hide this baby. This doesn't mean in the actual sanctuary where the worship of God was carried out, but in a room or apartment on the temple ground. Now let's figure, how many people are in this secret? Is it true that the more people know something, the harder it is to keep it secret? This class of 57, if I would tell 37 of you that we're going to have a quiz today and not tell the other 27, do you think the other 20, or the other 20, they might find out about it? Well, they might. If I would tell just one student we're going to have a quiz today and not tell anybody else, that wouldn't be right. But supposing I did such a wicked thing as that, still it might get out. But the more know something, the harder it is to keep it secret. That's why these officials in the Pentagon are so fond of using rubber stamps to say classified and top secret and everything. Now, Jehoshabeah knows it. Her husband, the high priest, Jehoiada, knows it. This couldn't have been done without his very substantial leadership and help. Probably they had one more woman, maybe two, as babysitters to spell Jehoshabeah part-time. And this would make a maximum of probably not more than 3 or at most 4 people that would know about this, and they are loyal, and this secret is well kept. Now, Jehoiada, a truly great man, he is a great patriot, a great lover of freedom, and a great saint. He waits 6 years. Why would he wait 6 years? It says, Athaliah did reign in the land. No details given of the reign. You can figure it out for yourself. Anybody that got power the way she got it would stop at nothing. This would be a reign of terror and bloodshed and the wickedest kind of oppression and tyranny. Also, it's noted that everybody was happy after she was dead. This is quite a comment on what it was like while she was alive. Now, 6 years. Why would he wait and let the country suffer this for 6 years? I can think of two reasons. Let's see if you can think of any. Well, Miss Harris, can you think of any reason? Miss Watkins, can you think of any reason? All right, he's got to make his plans and carry them out. Now, in addition to this, this is a tiny baby. An awful lot of things can happen to a tiny baby. In the years before they had public health and hospitals and everything, you know, many families in China have had 8 children and raised only 2. When you let children eat raw turnips off a vegetable stand at the bazaar that hadn't even been washed, let a 6-month-old baby eat one chew on it, it's not surprising if they sometimes get caught. Well, anyhow, this is a very tiny baby. He's going to give a little time for this kid to get a little older and stronger. Secondly, you see, it was necessary that the people get fed up with Athaliah. She is still an unknown as to how she will exercise power. Now, give her 6 years, and she's going to drop off the tree like a rotten apple. No. Difficulty. Just give her enough rope in the form of some time and she'll practically hang herself. But if you stage this attempted overturn too soon before the people have gotten fed up with her, why then it may not work. So he waits 6 years and he makes careful plans. Now, I want to quote a great man that isn't in the Bible, and that's Confucius. Most of these little smart sayings you read about Confucius say are made up in this country. But this one is authentic. One of his pupils, students or disciples, asked him once, the master, what kind of a man would you choose to be head of a state? This means to be the king or ruler of a country. And Confucius, after properly tickling his chin whiskers, replied, to be the ruler of a state, I would choose a man who will not, while unarmed, attempt to fight a tiger, or try to get an army across a river at a point where there isn't any bridge. The man whom I choose to be the ruler of the state must be careful, solicitous, making wise and careful plans and carrying them out carefully, step by step. Now, it isn't enough to be patriotic and religious. If you're going to accomplish anything really for God, you have to also be wise. And not attempt the foolhardy. And Jehoiada is not only a great saint and patriot, he's also truly wise. He doesn't try anything foolish that would be bound to fail almost. So he waits 6 years and then he starts putting his plans really into gear. The first thing is he takes the priests into his confidence. Now he is the head of the order of the priests. These men are under him. And he knows them man by man. And he knows also that of all the people in the country, he can most count on the loyalty of these men. They had many more priests than they needed. A great many more. And the priests were on active duty at the temple only a week, maybe in 2 or 3 years. A panel of, say, possibly 50 would be called up the rest of the time they lived in their towns and villages. This didn't mean they did nothing. They counseled people and had other duties, but called up to serve in Jerusalem at the temple for 1 week. And this was a great honor. And at the end of this week, they would go off duty and another shift would come on, called up. You might not get called up again for a couple, 3 years. So here's a panel that are going to go off duty when the Sabbath would begin. This would be Friday at sunset, and they would go off duty sometime earlier on Friday to go home. And Jehoiada carefully passes the word, very quietly though, don't go home, you stay here. I'm coming, we need you here. This would not be publicly noticed, because when these priests did go home, they didn't march out in a body. They'd left one or two at a time all day long in different directions, and it was completely inconspicuous. So nobody would notice this. Now there's a new panel coming on. This is also inconspicuous. They don't arrive all together. They arrive by ones and twos from north, south, east, and west. And nobody notices this either. So the net result is he's got double the usual number here, the priest. Now he tells them. Then he takes into his confidence a selected group of leading citizens that he knows he can trust, and tells them the electrifying news. She didn't kill them all. There is one true heir to the throne of David left that must be put up to be king. This is big news. So sudden, too. And these men are sworn to secrecy, of course, and they keep that pledge. So he's got the priests, and he's got a good-sized number of prominent citizens in on the secret now. And all pledge to secrecy until the moment comes. Next thing, they've got to have weapons, because there may have to be some resistance. How would it be to go to the queen and say, "Queen, we're starting a little fencing practice at the temple for the priests. They need some exercise. And wonder if you could let us borrow 100 or 200 swords from the royal army for a few days?" Obviously, this wouldn't do. Neither would it do for them to get weapons from any other ordinary source. It would raise suspicions right away. But they have on the temple grounds a historical museum of antiques, sort of the Smithsonian Institution of the Kingdom of Judah. And in this is a motley collection of antique weapons from former times. I don't know if they had the sling that David killed Goliath with in there or not, but they had a lot of swords from earlier times, including many from as far back as the time of David. And these are on the temple property, and the lock and key is under the control of Jehoiada, the high priest. Incidentally, the crown of the kingdom was there, too. And Athaliah was never anointed and was never crowned. The high priest has the crown of the kingdom, and he's not getting it out of storage for her. So she was never crowned. Now, he breaks out these antique swords. They're probably dull and rusty, but if sharpened up a bit, they could kill you pretty dead. And I suppose they took them into a basement or someplace and spent one night sharpening them up. And then a day or two later is the big day. They've got everything set. And Jehoiada has made his plans very carefully, step by step. He brings out little Joash, now age 7, and puts him by a pillar down the front of this large auditorium or room. And there he stands alongside with his priest's mitre, a special hat, a cap on his head, and his long flowing beard and long robes, and obviously the high priest, an elderly and very dignified figure. And then he has a half circle of armed men from corner to corner of this room in a semicircle surrounding him from one corner to the other, armed with swords. And he tells these men, "You are to defend the young king with your life. And nobody but nobody is to get through this line of men. And if anybody tries to kill them right then and there, instantly." And they'll do it too if necessary. So the crown of the kingdom is put on the head of little Joash. Now there's two questions that are not answered in the Bible that I'd like to know the answer to. And the first is, what went through the head of Joash when they were putting this crown on his head? You ever listen to Linklater's program on Kids Say the Darndest Things? Authentic and unrehearsed, the amusing remarks of children. And I suppose if Joash could have been put on Linklater's TV program, it would have been quite a feature, what he was thinking about. Let me tell you, kids think long thoughts sometimes. And the Bible doesn't tell you, you can only guess. The second question I have is, did this crown go clear down over his ears? It wasn't made or designed to fit a seven-year-old, or did they pad it with a Turkish towel or something on the inside so it would fit better? No answer to that either. You have to guess at that one, too. Anyhow, they get him properly anointed and crowned in the name of the Lord with benefit of clergy and everything, you know, which that's why I've never been. And there's a loud, rousing cheer and shouting. Long live the king! God save the king! And so forth. And you can hear this at the royal palace, which was only approximately a quarter of a mile away. Jerusalem in Old Testament times was not very big, and the royal palace, this is known, was not over about a quarter of a mile away. And Athaliah heard it. Whether she could hear the actual words articulated isn't known, but she heard the shout and came from the direction of the temple. So she took out on the run. Now, I wonder, do you suppose Athaliah was in fit condition and could run a mile in 4 minutes? She's got a quarter of a mile to run here. That just would be 1 minute if she could run a mile in 4 minutes. Well, she ran fast anyhow. I'll guarantee you one thing. Her speed on the return trip was greater than her speed on the original trip. You know, there was an extra complement of adrenaline in her bloodstream on the return trip that enabled her to speed it up. All right, she runs as fast as she can get there to where this shout has come from, and here's an open door, and she possibly stepped a step or two inside, and sees this scene. Here's this semicircle of armed men, and down beyond them is a pillar, and a little boy with a gold crown on his head, and the high priest standing alongside. Nobody has to explain this. It explains itself. There's only one possible meaning. Takes her about 4 or 5 seconds to dig this. And then she lets out a yell, "Treason! Treason!" Now, where there's treason, there's a traitor. Who's the traitor here? Well, who would it be? Who is the traitor really here? Mr. Ranger, who would you say is the traitor? There isn't one. Well, Athaliah means Jehoiada the high priest is a traitor. He's crowning somebody king while she's trying to be queen. However, by rights, Athaliah is the traitor. You see, who's a patriot and who's a traitor depends somewhat on which side you're on. Now, Jehoiada is the one who is defending and protecting and restoring the lawful constitution of the country according to the law of God and the will of God. Therefore, he's not really a traitor. He's a patriot. And Athaliah is the one who has lawlessly violated the constitution and put herself in as a female dictator, but without any form of law or right. So she is really the traitor. But you can't expect her to see it that way, of course. She shouts, "Treason, treason!" Now, she hadn't tried to get through that line. She's standing between that line and the door. But some of Jehoiada's men step out, and they're going to kill her right there. And Jehoiada says, "No, not in here. This is the holy place. This is sacred to God. Get her outside and kill her." So they get her outside. They didn't have to drag her out. She went out. And she starts to run for the royal palace with some of Jehoiada's soldiers right behind her with the sharp point of their swords poking them at her middle of her back. Now, would you say that would increase the speed at which a person would be able to run under those circumstances? Well, I'm sure it would. She ran as fast as she could, and they're always just about one jump behind her and gaining on her, you know. And she almost gets there to the royal palace. The entrance to it that was nearest to where she's coming from was the back door, not the front door. Back door, where they bring the potatoes and stuff in. But she isn't going to wait to go in and go in by the front door in style. She starts to go in by the back door. And just before she can get in the door, Jehoiada's men catch her and kill her right there with their swords. And she drops dead on the ground, and could a family form like her mother Jezebel, she dies in a driveway. Remember, Jezebel was tossed out the window, and in the roadway outside the palace, Jehu ran his chariot over her. This is runs in the family here. Athaliah died the same way. A little comment there. All the people of the land rejoiced when they had slain Athaliah with the sword. How'd that be for an obituary? Everybody was happy when she was dead. This tells you something about how she had been while she was alive. Now, Athaliah is dead and Joash is king. Next thing, there was a great wave by this time of popular enthusiasm, and this crowd of people that had gathered went to the Temple of Baal. Now, there wasn't supposed to be any Temple of Baal in Jerusalem. This was out of bounds for Temples of Baal. But there was one there, and it had a priest named Matan, M-A-T-T-A-N. Who do you suppose had that Temple of Baal built in Jerusalem? Right near the Temple of the Lord, of course. It couldn't have been far from it. It was in the city. Well, Athaliah, of course. So the people tear down the Temple of Baal. They worked off their blood pressure tearing this down. And Matan, the priest of Baal, they killed him. If he'd have stayed where Baal was supposed to be worshipped, he might have lived longer. And so he was dead. Now then, Joash is king, 7 years old. I wonder, can a 7-year-old run a country? Do we ever have, Ms. Sandino, you think we ever have public officials with a mental age of 7? This ever happen? Well, do we have college professors with a mental age of 7? Students with a mental age of 7? No, not really. 8 maybe, but not 7. Well, no, we don't have them either. They couldn't get by the college board. All right, he's 7 years old and obviously can't run the country, and Jehoiada the high priest runs it with a panel of prominent citizens whom everybody respects to advise and consent. And Jehoiada is a good man and a wise man, and he is, to use a Latin phrase, in loco parentis to Joash. He is in place of his father and mother and pastor and Boy Scout troop leader and guidance counselor and everything. And Joash does all right as long as Jehoiada is there to guide him and to train him. And there's an interesting little touch when Jehoiada decided that Joash was old enough to get married. He picked him out 2 wives. This isn't right, but it's an interesting comment on the inconsistencies and unawareness of what's really right in God's word on the part of even the best of people back at this time. I suppose, although polygamy isn't right, that the 2 wives that Jehoiada picked out for Joash were good ones. I suppose nothing like Jezebel or Athaliah. They were probably a different kind of person entirely. Now, later, Jehoiada died at an advanced age and was mourned by the whole country and buried with great honors. This man was regarded with something of the high honor and respect that we accord to George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. And in a way, you could say he was the father of his country. He had saved it from ruin here. But Jehoiada is dead, and this leaves Joash to stand on his own. Now, he is like some young fellow in America who, as long as he is in his hometown with his pastor and high school teachers and principal and his father and mother and his Boy Scout troop leader, all there to kind of coach him, he goes straight. But getting in Paris, France, where the temptations are and the guidance isn't, and first thing he's involved in moral wrongs and temptations. Instead of going to church in Paris, he goes to the cabaret or to the folly or something like this, and one thing leads to another. Well, a committee of men waits on Joash and says, "It's too strict around here. Why do you have to be so narrow-minded? Please let up a little bit. ease up on this religious policy, and this means, please, if you don't mind, we'd like to worship Baal sometimes. That's what that really means. And Joash agreed to this, which he shouldn't have done. And so this is a backward step here. Idolatry is going to be allowed in again. And one man comes to Joash and has the moral courage to tell him he's done wrong. And this is Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada. It doesn't say in the record in the Bible that Zechariah was the high priest. Probably he was, though, because this was hereditary and he was the son of Jehoiada. However, he may have been a younger son and therefore only one of the priests and not the high priest. This is possible. Anyhow, he comes and tells Joash plainly, you have done wrong. Joash can't take it. He is so furious, he orders, and the orders are carried out, Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada, to be stoned to death. He was lynched, martyred, killed unjustly for nothing else than doing his duty and telling the truth, and it was done on the grounds of the temple of the Lord. Now here's as foul a murder as you can find in the pages of history. You see, Joash wouldn't even have been alive, except that Jehoiada, the high priest, had had a pity on him and had saved him and seen to it that that's why I didn't kill him. Now, everything that Joash is, he owes to Jehoiada, the high priest. He rewards this kindness by having the son of Jehoiada murdered. Jehoiada wouldn't let them kill Athaliah on the grounds of the temple of the Lord to get her outside and kill her. But the son of Jehoiada is murdered on holy ground, on the premises and grounds of the temple of the Lord. So this is murder, the basest kind of callous ingratitude, and also sacrilege. Now, this was pretty nearly more than the people of Jerusalem could stomach. This murder of the son of the high priest who had been so honored by the kingdom. And not only the good people, but even the bad people couldn't quite swallow this one. And a little later, there was a plot against Joash. Now, you know, who is going to administer justice when the king of a country is guilty? Or do you have to just let him fall into the justice of God? Well, the justice of God, in a way, got a hold of him. He is stricken with an incurable disease. And then it says his servants. This doesn't mean the cook and dishwasher. This means the Secretary of State, Secretary of Treasury, and so on, his cabinet officers. They who were closest to him and knew him best decided he'd lived too long. They couldn't stomach what he had done, and they ganged up and killed him. So Joash was killed. If you had been on a jury to try the killers of Joash, would you have convicted them or acquitted them? Was this a murder or was it an execution, killing Joash, who had the son of the high priest stoned to death? Now, that's a difficult question. I'll say more about it next time, but I think you have to divide that. Did Joash deserve to die? Certainly, yes. Secondly, did they have a right to kill him? This is doubtful. They probably did not. Later, the son of Joash has these men put to death for murder. That comes up next time. We'll take it up again. Now, we got about 5 minutes left. I want to tell you a story somewhat parallel to this from my own experience in China. I caught a Chinese in my kitchen one day talking to the cook. His name was Liu, L-I-U, and pronounced as if it was L-E-O. And he was a spy doing the dirty, dirty job of working for the secret police, spying on priests, pastors, and missionaries, and Christian schools and hospitals. This fellow, Leo, had a history background. I caught him in my kitchen. I'll say more about what I said to him. But here he was. He had been abandoned on the street as an unwanted baby years before. A foundling baby simply dropped on the street. This happened in China back in those times. And he would have died. But the Chinese Christian pastor of the Chinese Presbyterian Church in this large city found him and had pity on him, and took him home, and gave him a home, and put him through school, He was baptized and professed to be a Christian, and everything this fellow had, he owed to the Christian church and its organizations and offices, or he would have been dead. And all this kindness he rewarded by becoming a spy working for the Japanese secret police of the Japanese occupying forces there, spying on missionaries and pastors and priests and Christian hospitals and institutions. A dirty, dirty business. And here he was in my kitchen asking the cook where I'd been, where I was going, how much money I got in a year, and a lot of other stuff was none of his business, really. So I decided I would commit the unpardonable sin of making him lose faith. You know, in China, you can steal somebody's money, you can punch them in the jaw and knock them down, you can run off with their wife. All this can be forgiven, but to make somebody lose faith, that's the limit. And Mr. Little, come into my office, please. So he came in, sat him down in the place of honor for a guest. The hostess to sit nearest the door. Get your guest farthest in the room, otherwise it's an insult. So I got him in there, the place of honor. So, Mr. Little, I am running an above-board life. I don't have any secrets, the kind of thing you're looking for. If you want to know where I've been and where I'm going and so forth, you come in here and ask me and I'll tell you. You don't need to sneak around in the back, behind my back, asking the cook. This made him lose faith, of course. And he kind of huffed and puffed a little and sort of said he didn't mean anything bad by it and so on. And I started to show him out. Now, in China, you don't just show a guest to the door of your house. You take him clear out across the yard or the property to the main gate of the property facing the public highway. There was a campus of a school. It was many acres, a big place. And I walked him clear out to the main gate that went out to the outside world. And on the way out there, this fellow, remember, he'd been baptized and told people he was a Christian. I don't think there was more than about a tenth of a milligram of Christianity in the system, but he said he was a Christian. And nominally, at least, you see. And so on the way out, he said to me, why do you Christians have to make such an awful fuss at bowing at the shrine of the Japanese sun goddess, Amaterasu? Which they were forcing people to do. They wouldn't torture Americans, but they tortured plenty of Chinese to make them do this. Bowing at the shrine of the sun goddess, mythical ancestors of the Emperor of Japan. He said, everybody knows there's no spirits or gods in that shrine, and it's just a formality. Why do you have to make such a fuss? Why don't you do what the government says and get it over with? And after all, he said, it's only your neck that bows and not your soul. Now, there's a picture up there of the early Christians being eaten by lions and burned at the stake because they would not compromise. That's why Christianity is a living faith still today. But this fellow Liu said, why do you have to make such a fuss? You see, real Christians wouldn't do it. And I said, Mr. Liu, why I made him lose faith. It was awful. Maybe I shouldn't have. But Mr. Liu, if you were a non-Christian Chinese, I wouldn't even answer that question. But since you have been baptized and go around telling people that you are a Christian, I will answer your question. As you say, it's only our neck and not our soul that bows at the shrine. And we know just as well as you do, there's no gods or spirits in that little building. And it's only your neck and not your soul. But you see, Mr. Liu, the trouble is, we Christians don't want to be in the embarrassing position of having our soul go to heaven and our neck go to hell. Goodbye, Mr. Liu. And I showed him out the gate. That was that. We'll stop there.